Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Rory Sutherland's On Brand, brought to you by Alf Insight. In each episode, we talk to the big names from the world of advertising, marketing and media to dissect and debate success, ingenuity and the future possibilities for our industry. And today I'm delighted to welcome Annie Morris and Johnny Shimin, who are the co-founders of Spoon Cereals, a granola brand that started as an idea at a family barbecue in 2013 and went on to secure investment on Dragon's Den the following year. It's now stocked in supermarkets, food halls and independent shops across the UK. Now, Annie, Johnny, both of you, you launched Spoon as an urban cereal product at a time when actually a lot of people probably outside the United States or North America didn't necessarily know what granola was. How did you land on it as an idea, and how confident were you that you had a successful product on your hands to begin with?
Sure. Hi, Rory. Thank you so much for having us. So Spoon really is built from a personal obsession with breakfast. Sounds a bit strange, but I love cereal and have done from a very young age. I used to take it as a snack with me into school. I used to have bowls of cereal at all times of the day at uni. And then when I got my first job as a creative in an agency in Soho, London, it was really the sort of the ritual of breakfast as well as the actual product that I loved. So I would kind of customize my bowl with all sorts of cereals, mixing them and enjoying them with yogurt and fresh fruit. And I think one of the reasons I love it so much is that I'm not really a morning person. So it gave me that reason to really jump out of bed in the morning. And then at the same time, this is 2013, and we were seeing quite a bit of a shift within the food scene in London. And it was more about this sort of unstuffy dining experience that consumers were looking for. And we were seeing all these sort of hipster street food markets with posh burgers and sourdough pizzas popping up, as well as amazing healthy food cafes to go to for lunch. So that said, when it came to breakfast, you had really had like a Pret, very sugary granola pot, or a pastry to pick up on your way to work. So it was during this time that I had the idea for Spoon, which was to make the breakfast occasion sort of more aspirational and provide a better quality bowl that we could serve fresh to people on the go. And that's when I met Johnny, and together we actually launched the brand initially as a pop-up concept with the vision of having our own fixed site somewhere in a central London location where we would capture commuters on their way to work. And when it came to the actual product, though, it was just simply starting out by experimenting with lots of different granola recipes at Johnny's flat. We sourced lots of wholesale ingredients that were kind of really high quality. They were organic. And then we experimented with lots of different ways to sweeten the granolas with maple syrup as our chosen sweetener, just because it provided a really lovely, rich, luxurious taste. Johnny has lots of fond memories of Canada, which he can tell you about. He has quite a lot, a link there. So it felt right to use. And yeah, arguably it was kind of healthier and a bit more premium than the brands on the supermarket shelves at the time. I think in terms of like why we were confident about the product is that also in the early days, we were amongst some of the first food and drink startup brands that were launching at the beginning of this global health wave that's really morphed and kind of grown over the last decade. And our products were appealing to consumers that wanted to pay a bit more for a better quality, healthier alternative, food and drink alternative. And on top of this, I think we were able to compete with the competition at the beginning. It was from a visual identity perspective, and in particular with our packaging design that was tapping into this sort of aesthetic of a more culturally relevant kind of lifestyle brands. And ultimately, we were bringing in a younger audience to the category. And sort of standing out against the more rustic, countrified brand leaders that were already out there.
Now, I mean, what's very clear is the packaging is very distinct. And you're right, most of these brands that you would have been competing with use the kind of imagery of milling and harvest and so forth. And you describe yourself as an urban cereal brand. And the packaging is very distinctive. It's not in colourways that you'd expect in the category necessarily. You'd also spotted something, which is that no one has really worked out before how to fully premiumise breakfast. And I think there's something really extraordinary going on, actually, not only in the food space, but also in the drink space and the alcoholic drink space, where the growth of kind of artisan provision is really spectacular. How well did the initial idea go of selling it from pop-ups? Did that work?
We were able to get a really good understanding of our target audience at the time without having to pay big market research agency fees. Typically, your granola muesli buyer in the supermarket was a lot older at that time. And I think the sort of this art selling at markets is something that's pretty central to our brand story, and it's really what kind of defines the spirit of the brand. I think we could have gone down a more generic route of, you know, developing the product concept and finding a manufacturer, investing behind the brand right at the beginning, and then selling into retailers that way. But we collectively decided that if we were to take the bootstrapped approach, not only is it less risky from a cost perspective, but we were able to kind of get our products out there, create a bit of buzz, and secure press features off the back of some of the pop-ups that we've done, and then secure some of our first stockists. So it's been quite a long route to market, but probably a lot less risky.
It's interesting. I think Innocent started at a festival, didn't it? They started selling direct as well.
Yeah.
And you make a very valid point, which is when you sell direct, you enjoy early stage feedback and often actually surprising discoveries as to who buys and when, which you simply won't learn and won't inform your future activities if you sell conventionally through intermediaries. Johnny, your background's in investment rather than advertising. And you obviously have a Canadian connection, hence the healthy obsession with maple syrup. What particularly attracted you to the idea?
So, well, Annie didn't mention up front, but she's my sister-in-law. So, you know, when your sister-in-law asks you to potentially help out with a business idea, you know, it's a little bit difficult to say no, or at least a little bit more complicated. But as you say, my background is, my mother's Canadian. And so, you know, as a child, we would go over to Canada for the summer holidays and enjoy maple syrup. And as part of the development process of the products, you know, we wanted to, as you talked about premiumization, we wanted to make it premium. We wanted to make it healthier. And so maple syrup was incorporated just naturally because it's a fantastic product. And I think that I was very happy to get involved because my background is actually in investment, as you say, but focused on food and drink brands. So I worked as an analyst in the city of the likes of Unilever, Nestle, Cadbury, Schweppes, as was. So I had a good understanding of brands and what makes brands work, but from a commercial and financial perspective. And I'd always wanted to you know, put my money where my mouth was and have a go. And so when we started developing the products and started getting the initial feedback that we talked about from markets, and it's very honest feedback, you know, you're having a dialogue with people every week at the markets, you're having repeat customers tell you exactly why what you're doing is great or what you're doing is not great. And that was super valuable. And I became very confident that we had a fantastic product. You mentioned the packaging. You know, Annie from the word go has created a lovely look and feel for the brand, which reflects what's going on in the pack. It's simple. It reflects that we're tasty. It reflects that we're healthy. And I think that has been a large part of the success. And that's been something from day one that people have mentioned as a standout. And I think that for me, what our packaging does and the way we talk on our packaging and why I've been confident that this will be a great business is that it's straightforward and it's honest. And, you know, we've seen cereal brands and lots of other brands and startups in food and drink have a go at, you know, doing what we are doing, but do it in a slightly different way. And as Annie mentioned, you know, develop a product, secure investment behind it, go large. And we've seen a lot of brands disappear as well. And I think that, you know, what we fundamentally always come back to is we have a great product. We're not a hype train. People aren't going to read about us, hear about us, and then get the product and be very disappointed. People are going to get the product, think this is a fantastic, fantastic product. And so that's why that early stage was super important for us, is to get the product exactly right, understand what people wanted, understand the trends. And, you know, that's something, again, I brought and Annie brought from a different direction from the advertising side, you know, understanding trends and understanding what people want going forward. And being a step ahead of the game when it comes to what's next has also been something that's been very important for us as a business.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because this trend towards the premiumization of basic things is very, very interesting. You could also say, by the way, I think it's environmentally very, very beneficial that, you know, if you can have increased wealth in society, but where people spend the incremental wealth not on doing more things or having more of the same, but actually in doing the same things better, it's something, you know, we can generally hope to encourage, I think. And one of the things that really fascinates me, particularly in the food and drink category, is the number of things that have probably failed because they're too cheap. So you have this mindset in manufacturing, which is all about cost reduction. You have a mindset in retail, which is all about discounting or low prices. And actually, what we know from the wine industry is what drives the price of wine people buy is occasion. That people feel the need for a special occasion. And on such occasions, a treat is only a treat if it hurts your wallet a little bit. And you see these very interesting things. Peloton is one case where it was largely unsuccessful until they ratcheted the prices up. A fascinating case is British sparkling wine is absolutely fascinating. For as long as it was priced at £8.95, it wasn't going anywhere because it didn't matter how good the wine was. If people could suspect you'd bought it because it was £8.95, not because it was good, it didn't have any signalling value in terms of hospitality. And so I see this as, you know, and of course we call it breakfast cereal, but I think one of the things you spotted is that a lot of people eat it at multiple times of the day, don't they, in fact? And particularly, again, if you make it pretty special, the consumption opportunities go up. One thing that is interesting when you are selling from pop-up places, breakfast cereal isn't very portable, okay, by definition. And it's also something we feel really awkward eating in public, isn't it? I don't know why that is. But somehow eating, you know, standing in a street corner with a bowl and a spoon feels goddamn weird in the way that eating a bar wouldn't. How did you actually deal with that? Did you have tables and chairs? Did you How did you serve it? You presumably had to have a choice of milks, because you do nowadays. You can't just have milk. How did you solve those problems?
The sort of format of the packaging that we used was paper cups, similar to the kind of porridge pots that you get on the go. So that was kind of the format of how we were serving the fresh pots.
Yeah, people wouldn't eat in front of us. It was designed for people to grab and go, to take to their offices. But
yes,
you know, I think that one thing we realized quite quickly, and one of the things that helped us transition from you know, being part of the food service and catering world into being part of the sort of wholesale ambient retailer world, was that people were buying packs from us to take home. And again, that's back to the, you know, we wouldn't have had that specific learning without getting out there and selling it live face to face to people. And so, you know, people were taking a pot to the office, telling their friends about it at work, and they were coming down to buy packs of granola to take home. And that was one of the things that helped us transition. And I don't think yet, by the way, anyone's properly solved the, you know, the portability of a good wholesome breakfast. And, you know, it's something that has vexed us for a little while. We've got a few ideas as to how we'd like to work on that going forward, and what we'd like to present to the world. But I think that's a solution that's yet to happen.
I know there are these wonderful things out there which one day someone will find the psychological solution. And a lot of it is just feelings of awkwardness. As you say, no one will stand on the street spooning. Don't ask me why. It's just, you know, one of those strange things. I often refer to things as being Coke or Dr. Pepper. In other words, things that feel completely normal to consume and things that require explanation and justification and make you feel a bit weird, you know. Yeah. And, you know, that I was talking about the, funnily enough, I was talking about the pandemic, and I said the strange thing is that video conferencing or video calling used to be Dr. Pepper and now it's Coke. You know, there's a kind of transition you can make. I've always thought, by the way, anybody in the tea industry who can find a way of getting rid of that hassle with the tea bag. Because quite often when I'm on the go, I order coffee, not tea. Not because I prefer coffee to tea. I'd honestly rather have a cup of tea, but I can't be bothered with the faff. And if anybody can solve that problem.
People have tried. We saw a startup that tried that. And I think you're pushing against the huge cultural weight. When it comes to the tea bag, people love that ritual, you know, which is, you know, again, that's that way up between convenience and actually the ritual of the enjoyment of the product, which is something that breakfast has, you know, there's a lot of that in breakfast.
Do you, I mean, it's interesting, actually, on your website, which is, I'll give a good plug here. It's spooncereals.com. Is that right?
.co.uk.
Yeah. That's it. You also have quite a few recipes there, and so one of the great advantages of home consumption is people can customize a bit, because I notice that people always do. There's a wonderful comedy sketch by Andy Parsons, the comedian, who makes the point that there's a serving suggestion on shredded wheat that says "tastes delicious with strawberries." And he said, "That's not really very surprising because strawberries are delicious." He said, "I've never bought a punnet of strawberries and it has on it serving suggestion tastes great with shredded wheat." Okay, the reverse doesn't really apply. But there, you know, the other thing is multiple, as you said, multiple times a day. David Ogilvy, the founder of Ogilvy, was famously cranky and would demand Post's Grape Nuts, which is also a favourite breakfast cereal of mine, once described as the most Protestant of all breakfast cereals by a Catholic friend of mine, which is the idea that you really shouldn't enjoy yourself, but it's okay to consume some nourishment in a highly puritanical form. I love it, actually. David Ogilvy would ask for this at dinner. He'd go to a kind of Michelin-starred restaurant, demand a bowl of Grape Nuts. But this kind of thing
sounds like our perfect customer.
He'd be your perfect customer, yeah. Every moment was a consumption opportunity, I think, with him. You decided to go to the Dragon's Den. Now, for the benefit of people listening outside the UK, they may know that as Shark Tank. It's a programme format that's pretty much taken off in Canada, the United States, I know. Why, given your connections with the investment world, why did you go to the Dragon's Den for funding?
Well, it was a very easy way to raise awareness. You know, there's lots of very difficult ways to raise awareness, but putting your face in front of 4 million viewers, which is around what Dragon's Den has in the UK, and quite a lot more when it repeats, you know, and also in countries like Australia, New Zealand, South Africa also get it. We got weird spikes in geographical traffic on our website at certain times afterwards based off that. But it was a decision primarily to raise awareness. And the other thing was, because we did it so early in our journey, at the time we were a concept, and you know, we were still developing our thinking and pretty much doing it part-time. And so we hadn't actually settled into doing the work full time on Spoon as a business. And what we pitched to the Dragons was Annie and myself to build the business and to take the business wholesale. So that was the moment that we pitched that idea, and we went in, you know, with positive attitude to it and to securing investment. But we weren't sure whether we were going to do it. But actually, when Peter and Deborah, Peter Jones and Deborah Meaden, offered to come on board, we were actually very happy to you know, it was we gave away quite a chunk of equity for quite a small amount of money. But they did succeed in helping us open doors. And given that neither of us had background in retail or in actually in the operational side of the business, we thought that those doors would be very helpful. And they were. You know, Peter helped us in securing a Sainsbury's listing. You know, I think our products did quite a good job of that as well, given that they won great taste awards and you know, we're receiving fantastic customer feedback. But Peter helped us with that. He gave us office space. Deborah was very active in helping out with the business. So it was an active decision to raise awareness that helped us out a tremendous amount in the early years. Obviously, they both have experience in building up brands in the FMCG space. And that experience was, you know, then directed into Spoon. And given the background that Annie and I had, we felt we were very complementary, which is why we actually accepted their offer.
No, but I mean, it's a very congratulatory comment here, but I don't think I've seen Deborah Meaden ever invest in anything. So it's quite an impressive thing that you managed to secure her along with Peter.
She was fantastically helpful and very active in her involvement. I should say, just you know, for the record, they're no longer involved in the business now. After a few years of them being invested, we took the decision to buy them out of the business, and you know, take back that equity piece that we. We sold to them, and that was all done in a very amicable way, and a way that was acceptable to all parties. And we wanted to take the business forward. So you know, they played a very important role in building the foundations and the roots of what we have now. But they haven't been involved now for about 3 years. Just sort of to make sure that everyone's clear on that.
But as you say, it's a fantastic way of reaching millions of people very, very fast. And I think
absolutely.
I think we're in danger of entirely with the obsession in marketing of micro targeting and hyper targeting and measurement, we're missing the value of just fame, familiarity, and fame, and also the belief not only that you're aware of something, but that other people are aware of it. In other words, that you know, you give a product a certain degree of talkability as well. Those things are much more valuable. They're harder to measure, but that doesn't make them any less valuable. And I think we've become obsessed with quantification to a point where it's starting to distort business activity. How do you promote yourselves currently? So your distribution is sort of Ocado, Waitrose, Selfridges Food Hall. You've started fairly much at the top end of the market. Makes perfect sense. Do you do any particular promotion with, for example, Ocado? Because it strikes me that actually these online food delivery businesses are quite helpful to innovation in the sense that they don't have the usual shelf constraints that conventional supermarkets do. A conventional supermarket will always have to take you at the expense of some other brand, whereas conceivably yep. Ocado can effectively just add you to your repertoire and there's no opportunity cost, if you like. So did you find Ocado particularly receptive? Do you do any? Because one thing that drives me nuts, by the way, about Ocado, if there's anybody from Ocado listening, why they don't allow you to search by Great Taste Award winners on the site? So I don't. We do a lot
with Ocado, and as you say, the benefit of Ocado to a small brand like us is that there's not too much risk to them as a business by having a much broader range, and so we got a listing with Ocado early, and at the time we were very cash constrained as a business. We've gone through various periods of cash constraints, and one of the periods that coincided with was our launch in Ocado. So we didn't spend much money with them to begin with. And as a result, we grew quite slowly. But they, the work when you can do it together with them on the trade side is very, very effective. And so in the last 24 months, last 2 years, we've put quite a bit of our resources into growing our presence on Ocado. And targeting of search terms and the advertising that you can do in terms of banners is actually very, very effective. And so we have actually seen fantastic growth in our business on Ocado. And I think part of that is also the fact that we can do stuff together with other brands to raise awareness as well. So you can have a lovely little bundle deal. We had last month a bundle deal with a load of other startup brands in honey space, peanut butter space, bread space. Just create a little breakfast bundle, and then you've got actually a very cheap way of creating awareness over and above just the presence on the site. So there's lots of nice innovative things you can do that would be very difficult in a traditional retailer to organize just from a physical space point of view. And so we've had a lot of success doing that so far with Ocado, and they're a great customer of ours.
I mean, I love those bundles in the sense that they allow you to actually promote without overt discounting. So you're not actually changing the price of what you're charging, but you're simply giving people a kind of multi-buy offer across several categories. And the other great advantage with Ocado, I always think, is they can spot what products really engender loyalty. And personally, it drove me insane when Sainsbury's delisted Collier's cheddar cheese, because my hunch would be, if you're a Welsh cheese connoisseur, you might be. It may sell to comparatively few people, but to those few people, it's a staple. Now, the great point about stocking those things is not necessarily for their overall value, but the contribution they make to the person's propensity to visit. And Ocado obviously can enjoy a huge advantage through niche products. In other words, if only 3% of your customers have a culty relationship with a particular brand and they can only find that brand on Ocado, it's going to drive quite a lot of, regularity of purchase. And, theoretically, at least, I think loyalty cards should make that explicit, but I'm not sure it's always used in that way. There are things that a lot of people buy occasionally, and there are things that a few people buy a hell of a lot. I remember talking to marketing director of Tesco. What was his name? Mason. I was going to say James Mason, but he's an actor. But he made a very interesting point that they looked at their what you might call the free from range, the range that was suitable for people with, say, celiac disease, gluten intolerance, veganism, etc. And they realised the same thing about that not many people bought it. But for the people who did, it was almost a reason to go to Sainsbury's. So the category value shouldn't have been the delineator. It's really the effect it has on wider behaviour that you need to find. This is, again, a danger with ever more kind of, disaggregated measurement, that you actually start obsessing about the value of the parts rather than the value of the sum. And I generally, the other thing is, I suspect on Ocado, and actually that's true of Click and Collect when I go to Sainsbury's, that you shop in a fundamentally different way.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You know, you can throw, you know, and the opportunity, by the way, to cross sell is really quite magical. You know, you can recommend complimentary goods to go with. You know, if someone buys hot dogs, you can suggest, you know, the brioche rolls that go with it and so on.
But this exactly. is and the other from a small brand perspective, the other thing that makes Ocado great is the data, because it lets us see exactly how we are performing relative to other brands in our sector and even individual product lines based on certain metrics. Loyalty is one of those that you mentioned. So it allows us to put out a fantastic case study. And you talked about the fact that we've focused on being, you know, we're relatively limited in our distribution, and we tried to do that deliberately. We've had a restrained growth objective to put a halo on what we're doing. We have actually just launched over into Migros in Switzerland, which is the joint market leader over there, largely based on you know, sort of the halo that we put on the brand and the business here. They see the high quality of what we're doing. And you know, that some of the data that we are able to look at from Ocado around customer loyalty, around which brands we outperform, and it would be very surprising to you to see some of the individual products that we outperform. And it allows us to now make that push into the broader space and the bigger boys, knowing with full confidence that there will be success for certain of our products based off what they've achieved. So that's a huge advantage to working with Ocado. And I would encourage any smaller brands that you know, are potentially listening to this to invest in the data and look at exactly how they're performing, because it will hopefully give you fantastic ammunition to go out to the wider world.
So what are your plans next? I mean, you've established, I think, you know, great authenticity. You've established very, very clear distribution in premium spaces. Do you plan to expand internationally first? Do you plan to expand distribution in the UK? Range extensions? What, without giving away any trade secrets, what's in the pipeline?
I think one of the big challenges for us at Spoon has been establishing the production strategy and getting that right. I think it's one of the big challenges that any food and drink startup will face, especially if you've got founders who don't come from an operational background. So that side of the business has taken us quite a lot of time to get off the ground. And what we've seen is during that time, lots of new players have entered the health and wellness industry. And so I think another big challenge we're currently facing is this element of sort of really rising up to our challenger brand, to a challenger brand status. And by that, I mean, I think there's more work to be done to make the exact sort of nature of our brand identity and belief system really more evident to the consumer. I actually recently read a quote, you might know this, Rory, which was that success means never letting the competition define you. Instead, you have to define yourself based on a point of view you care deeply about. And I thought that really sort of resonated with me. And I think that said, as a brand that exists to make breakfast better, we feel that Spoon is really well positioned to address the sort of unhealthy state of the cereal industry with not just, we've got lots of new product developments that are doing that, but also at a high level, really is that we're trying to think about what our brand belief really is, which we have always known sort of internally. And that is that health is not a sort of one size fits all, and that it needn't be bland or boring or restrictive. And that we think that sort of the breakfast occasion is a great place to start in changing this consumer perception. So that's one project that we're currently working on. But in terms of product and markets, we're looking at entering new categories within breakfast, and really answering, kind of further leaning into our commitment to provide the consumer with a healthier product, as well as something that's tasty.
Yeah, just because granola is a relatively small part of the overall market. You know, when you look down the cereal aisle, it's a long aisle. There's a lot of space there with a lot of different products. And I think that for us, you know, we've been a patient brand, and as I hopefully we've you know, got across, we're an honest brand. We're not about, you know, being a hype train, a star that burns very brightly and then implodes on itself. And so we have been working patiently behind the scenes on the next steps, and we are also a business that has basically, I think, you know, established now a nice deep complex root system from which hopefully we can grow very tall. And I think that the issue that we're trying to solve, as Annie mentioned, is the problem of eating a better breakfast. We have a reasonably simple purpose. We want to help people to solve that problem, and it's not about, you know, what we want. It's about helping people do that, and from their own perspective, we want to make honest products that we hope resonate with people to help them with their own goals. And I think that, you know, we put what we believe into our products, but we want to help the consumers, you know, to solve things for themselves. And I think that the products that we launch will reflect that, and will reflect the try to give people an additional healthier choice down the breakfast cereal aisle, whichever product category that specific product category that might be in. But that's the overall aim for the business. Whether that takes us internationally as well, you know, hopefully Migros is off to a great start for us. And we'll certainly be investing behind that. But I think, you know, the business will remain largely UK focused for now.
It's extremely interesting. I mean, taking on the Swiss in their home market, if you like, the people who originated muesli, is really rather interesting. But I mean, you've also invested, I think, in sustainable packaging, or particularly the liner. Is that right? You took a decision to invest in a cleaner form of containment.
Yeah, I always. We, as I mentioned, we are an honest brand that, and we try to do what we say on the tin. And when we talk about sustainability, we've been particularly disappointed with efforts from others in the category, and you know, also sometimes from other brands that talk a fantastic game and don't deliver it. And you know, I remember a specific story for me, and I won't mention the two brands' names, but they're both clothing brands, and I ordered from them slightly different times. And coincidentally, the orders arrived on the same day at my house. One is a UK-based business. One is a US-based business, but very global. And both of them talk fantastic sustainability story, and about protection of the environment. And they're very much about the outdoors and being in the environment. And therefore, why would you not want to protect it and do all you can? And one of the packages arrived. It was a beautiful It was a beautiful paper package, all branded inside, wonderful story, little card talking about exactly how to, you know, why the packaging was biodegradable, what they were doing as a whole. And there was no deceit involved in opening that package. The other package, I'd heard a great brand story, and I fully bought into the brand, arrived, plastic everywhere, you know, bubble lined paper. No story, nothing branded, just literally as if someone had in a warehouse thrown it into the back. And I felt deceived as a consumer. And one of these, the UK business, I am still a customer of, the US-based business, I haven't actually bought anything. And this was 2 years ago. I haven't actually bought anything from that brand, even though I love them. I love what they sound like they're about. But I felt deceived. And And what we want to be is honest and straightforward. So we moved into compostable packaging, and it was what we wanted to do. It wasn't actually the technology of the liner wasn't there yet. So we moved back into that, into a fully recyclable inner. But we are, as I say, trying to do our best. And we explain this to people in our newsletter, on the website, on the packaging, where we can. And all that this US company needed to do for me, and it was explained to me in a WhatsApp group I'm in, that potentially, you know, the plastic was the best thing to do for the environment, for various reasons. It's complicated. I understand that it's complicated. All they needed to do was put a little insert in explaining why they used it and why it fitted with their overall messaging. And then there wouldn't have been a deceit. I would have understood, but they didn't do that. So what we're trying to do is we're making these moves, but we want to be straightforward about it.
It's a very interesting thing, which is nearly always in e-commerce companies, marketing has no control whatsoever over logistics and distribution or packaging in many cases. And this is quite disturbing because, well, I mean, if there's anybody from Amazon listening, okay, there are occasions when I'd pay an extra pound to have you deliver the damn thing by Royal Mail, okay, which is, it's an SD card, it's something that weighs 3 grams at most, okay, or less, okay, and the postman's coming to my door anyway. I know what time he arrives. If it doesn't arrive tomorrow, well, I know it'll be there by 1 o'clock the following day. And I don't have to hover in all day in the expectation that a large van may turn up. And I don't want my house to turn into a kind of, you know, distribution hub with, you know, vans reversing, you know, every 3 hours. And the ability just occasionally to consolidate 3 or 4 purchases with the same courier, in this case Royal Mail, would actually be pretty valuable to me. And yet no one is given any choice because the whole thing is all about volume discounts and the efficiency idea, not customer preference. Yeah. And so I think there's something really important there, which is that marketers have this area which has a huge effect on customer experience, but over which they often have absolutely no control whatsoever.
And it's about the disconnect, though, isn't it? It's about the disconnect and the expectation. Completely. And if there was a disconnect, if someone had acknowledged that within the business, I would have been fine as a consumer, absolutely. And so I think one of the benefits of being a small business is we do not have that disconnect. You know, what the stuff we talk about, Annie, myself, and Sophie works in operations for us, and our warehouse and the manufacturing guys, we all know exactly what's going on in every aspect of the business. You know, a lovely example that Annie initiated was we started selling a mixed case online. And rather than have a new case designed and made, we actually just repurposed our old cases, and we just wrote on some tape that we've repurposed. And, you know, apologies if it's got a few dings and dents in it, but the tape explains the story. You've got a cinnamon and pecan granola case, but it's actually got 5 different of our products in it. And I think that's just a lovely little example of how you can get over that disconnect. You know, people think, oh, they've sent me the wrong thing. Oh, no, it's actually just their repurpose and packaging.
So you're right. The story determines the perception, not the reality. We had a lovely example of this where, you know, occasionally British Gas people would turn up late to a boiler servicing appointment. Now, the actual reason was they have a policy which is if there's for example, a single mum or an elderly person whose heating has broken down, they give them priority, quite rightly. But they weren't telling the people who are inconvenienced that this was the reason. Now, you know, if your British Gas guy turns up to service your boiler 2 hours late and says, I'm terribly sorry, I'm late, I had an emergency call to a pensioner in Bromley, I would have to be an absolute certified arsehole to get angry about that, right? Okay, I'm going to go, no, of course, that's fine. You know, absolutely. I wouldn't want you to do anything else. But quite often they would just say, I'm terribly sorry, I'm going to be late, without telling the reason behind it. And as a result, you get anger when you should get, actually, if anything, additional satisfaction, I would argue. Most people, I think, feel slightly good not being angry about something which is reasonable. You know, I think there's an emotional response there, which is often completely missed. I've got to ask this question, I suppose. Premium breakfast cereals, okay, not as many people are working from home as we like to think, but nonetheless, a large number of people are now working flexibly, which has probably changed their relationship with breakfast as a meal, making it a bit less time constrained. How did that affect kind of sales? Did you enjoy, generally, were pandemic sales up? do you think? In other words, people were putting more emphasis on this? Or were people going to the opposite extreme and cooking Eggs Benedict from scratch? what happened to breakfast during the pandemic?
Breakfast cereals sales rose significantly during the pandemic. It was one of the things that people were taking off the shelves alongside the loo roll and the pasta and the flour. Exactly for the reasons that you say, people, rather than having to grab their prep breakfast pot or their, you know, granola bar, they had time at home to enjoy it and, you know, take their spoon cereals and layer it up with their strawberries and bananas and what have you. So like all of the breakfast brands, we grew last year significantly. But the sort of corresponding effect also, where it was a negative effect on smaller businesses, is that people returned to brands that they knew and loved, the big boys. And what we've seen is that the whole category was uplifted in 2020, and has, you know, returned basically to the big boys experiencing not much growth this year, whereas smaller brands like us have continued to grow and benefit. So I think, you know, the way we have sort of explained it to people in the past was it was a very cheap way of getting a lot of free trial, free awareness, because, you know, for us potentially, when people couldn't get a Kellogg's or a Nestle product, they picked up a pack of spoon, whereas they might not have done in the past. So we got a lot of free trial, and we are, as a result, seeing continued growth of our customer base. Whereas as the normal has returned, the larger guys, and you see this coming through in the data, it's actually have settled back down to the regular pattern of it being a pretty stable category. But we're continuing to benefit from the initial growth that we saw in the pandemic, which has been great. And we're very thankful for that.
And as you said, if your loyalty figures, which Ocado reveals, are good, then trial is in and of itself pretty beneficial. That I think that's absolutely really important. I mean, actually, I remember reading one interesting I think it was a history of Coca-Cola by a man called Prendergast, which I'd recommend quite heavily. But they said that for the Coca-Cola company and for Wrigley's chewing gum, World War II was effectively a glorious global sampling exercise. That, yeah. I don't think that was the intention, but there are always these peculiar side effects and unintended consequences. And but your point about the flight to established familiar brands is also, you know, well established. Someone was describing to me the ethnography of the banking category, and they said that the way it's emerging is that you have the bank you trust and the bank you like. You have one traditional bank account and you have one bank account with a kind of fintech, startup. And you pay your salary into the bank you trust, but you actually do all the fun stuff with the bank you like. Yeah. And I think that divide is really, really interesting. I mean, I've got to ask this just for any entrepreneur listening, but Annie, you know, I'd be interested to know your take on this as well. Were there moments where you just despaired or thought this is hopeless, we've come up against an unstoppable obstacle? Or what, what was the, what was the greatest hurdle you ultimately faced? Or was there a point where you felt like packing it all in and going back to the advertising industry?
I think with any food and drink, any startup, you have extreme highs and lots more extreme lows. but I would say one of the big highs for us was at the beginning, launching into Sainsbury's. But with that, it really brought about lots of challenges, as we weren't really ready. We had just been on Dragon's Den, and at the time, we were making everything in-house. It was Johnny and myself running the business. We were doing everything ourselves. So making the granola, we were running pop-ups. We were supplying into local delis with my car, driving, delivering them ourselves. And it was really, really knackering. And then suddenly we've sort of catapulted into this FMCG world. And speaking to the big buyers of one of the top, like all of the top four supermarkets in the UK, And so, yeah, I think we learned the hard way, really. I think we didn't have a team, and you need you need resource and a helping hand to kind of really support your listings. And it's not rocket science. It's pretty straightforward, but I think with neither of us having that sort of that FMCG background, it was very much about sort of learning on the go. So I think that's one of the big challenges I touched on before about finding a production partner. That's been another a big challenge for us, and getting that right. It's taken us a long time, and I think both Johnny and I would both agree that we would have liked to be a little bit further ahead to where we are now in terms of size and revenue. But you know, it's a benefit, because we've got so much learning under our belts now, and we feel like we're in a really good position to kind of really drive the business forward now.
It is the great entrepreneur's curse, which is you can never control timing. I mean, in a perfect world, you might have been on Dragon's Den a year later, but you can't. There are always those aspects of timing that you can't control.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, when we were on Dragon's Den, it would have been amazing to have a listing in Sainsbury's at that time. But we had a very small presence online, so we had a big spike on our online sales, which was great. But yeah, so if we'd gone on to Dragon's Den a little bit later, that probably would have been more beneficial in terms of sales.
But you would, without wanting everybody at WPP to up sticks and start their own food brand, you would recommend it as a move. You're glad you did it.
To go on Dragon's Den?
Generally starting a business, leaving the world of wage slavery and starting your own business. You generally recommend the experience.
100%.
On balance. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you, there's a certain, like, I don't know, I think you have to have that sort of, I know it sounds really cliched, but like a lot of determination, and there's a lot of sacrifice. So I feel like I sacrificed my 20s, basically. I rarely kind of, you know, went out that much with friends, and when I did, it was just a massive blowout because I hadn't been out for so long. But it's been amazing at the same time. I think the reward you get from it, that feeling of putting in so much hard work, and then when things go your way, it's very satisfying.
I always think about it as the difference between like the short term wins which you have in a career, you know, the promotion, the bonus, the team trips, all of that stuff that you look forward to in the short term. We can't really play that game. We have to be very patient. It's a long term game. And you know, as you know, if you keep chasing rainbows, you never find the gold. And so if we are patient and do the right things, as we've talked about, and we're honest and we create trust, there will be the gold at the end of the rainbow. But we're just going to have to wait quite a while. So, you know, I think anyone who's looking to do their own thing needs, as Annie said, a lot of determination, absolutely a lot of patience, and you know, needs to know that it's long term. And the challenges that you mentioned, you know, the struggles, they are daily, weekly, all the time. And so, you know, you're constantly facing adversity in a very different way to the corporate world. So. If you can be sure that those things are things that you're happy with in your life, then it's absolutely a recommended way to go. But you know, patience, I think, is the key virtue that you need to possess.
I'm also really impressed with people that go it alone. So sole founders. I have always been since my whole career, I've been in a partnership. So I had a female creative partner. And then we went through a very upsetting breakup when I left the industry. And then, I could not do it on my own. I think there's like, you know, pros and cons for whatever decision you make. But, and you know, Johnny and I have gone through lots of sort of ups and downs, and it's difficult to you know, we try and separate family time and business as much as we can, but inevitably that sort of, there's a lot of crossover. Ultimately I take my hat off basically to people that start up on their own and have to do, you know, they don't have that sounding board. So when someone's feeling a bit,
I know. And also you enjoy very complementary skills. One of you comes from the world of investment, the other one comes from the world of branding. It's difficult to find in one place someone who can do all of those things.
Yeah.
And it becomes actually, you know, conceivably it becomes impossible at some level, which is why companies become larger and create departments. But it is a really, really interesting question that I agree with you that someone doing that on their own requires something which I could never muster. I think it would just be impossible for me to try and go alone on something like that. Apart from anything else, I've got, you know, far too many weak spots which would need filling in. But that's a fantastically encouraging note on which to end. I'd just like to say, Annie and Johnny, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. And just remains for me to say that that's all for this episode of On Brand. The podcast is brought to you by Alf Insight. And for more information on powering your business growth, visit their website at alfinsight.com. That's alfinsight.com. The series is produced and edited by Ultimate Sound and Vision, and they do an excellent job of it every time. And to make sure you receive the next episode, please do subscribe. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, then give us a like. So thank you enormously for listening, and here's to next time. Thank you very much indeed.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.